Hello and welcome to the Organic Research Centre podcast. My name is Vicky Smith. The Organic Research Centre, or the ORC for short, is an independent research charity working for better and more sustainable farming systems which promote the environment and provide good food for everybody. This is one of many podcasts which we will be recording to help celebrate our 40th anniversary throughout 2021. Hello everybody, thanks for joining us for this podcast. I was speaking to Lawrence Woodward and Keith Sumpton, who will both introduce themselves in a minute. It's been 20 years since the foot and mouth outbreak in 2001, and in this podcast we'll be looking back at their experiences and also discussing how Elm Farm Research Centre was involved. I hope you find it interesting. There'll be two parts of this podcast, and you're currently listening to part one. Hi Keith, hi Lawrence, thanks for joining us for this podcast. So Keith, should we start with you? Do you want to maybe give us a little bit of background to yourself and what you do?
Yeah, thank you. Yes, Keith Sumption. I'm currently Chief Veterinary Officer of the Food and Agriculture Organization of United Nations. 20 years ago, I was at Edinburgh University at the Centre for Tropical Veterinary Medicine, and I was responsible for one of the master's courses. I was a lecturer in international animal health, a specialist in viral diseases of international importance. And before I was at Edinburgh, I did a PhD in virology at the Purbright Institute. So I was very familiar from my time in the 80s with the major international diseases, African swine fever, foot and mouth disease, rinderpest, and so on. And that was very much part of my daily work, working with master's students from across the world when I was in Edinburgh.
Fantastic. Thanks, Keith. And then Lawrence, a little bit about you. I know you've featured in a couple of other podcasts that we've done in this series, but perhaps if people haven't listened before, you could give some background to yourself.
Okay, well, my background in organic began in the early 1970s when I was swept away by the notion of sustainability, having read various books at the time, notably John Seymour's self-sufficiency books. And my wife Alice and I decided that we wanted to become self-sufficient. This was before the famous Good Life program, or maybe around the same time. And we visited places, we visited Ireland and discovered people growing their own vegetables and having a pig in the back garden and so on. So we decided this was for us. Alice's father was the editor of the Observer newspaper at the time and was a great friend with Fritz Schumacher, who had produced the iconic book Small is Beautiful in 1968, I think. And lots of the chapters for the book were originally published in the Observer newspaper. And Small is Beautiful was the idea that we had to find technologies and ways of living that would fit into a limited planet. So it was one of the first really, as I say, iconic breakthrough pieces of work on the need to find ways of living, feeding ourselves, and appropriate technology that's fit for a world of finite and diminishing resources. So David Astor didn't really he didn't warm to our sort of ideas of dropping out and being self-sufficient. So we realized that if organic farming was to develop, there would need to be research and development, and there would need to be advisors, advisory services, and so on. So we created a charitable and education charity to carry out research and development in organic farming and in appropriate technology. That became Elm Farm Research Centre. So Elm Farm Research Centre actually started with me and a desk, and I'm still sat at the desk, and that was it. And we took over this farm and developed into the institution that was, by the year 2000 and 2001, We had a well-established research program. We had an advisory team of about 24 advisors. The Ministry of Agriculture, Fisheries and Food, as it then was, had finally recognized the value of organic farming. We were developing standards. We had developed standards and things were okay. And then, so I was director. We had research team, we had advisory teams, we had an outreach team, we had demonstration farms. We had clients, advisory clients and farmers we'd worked with for a long time. Then foot and mouth hit. And all of the things that we've been talking about alternatives, and particularly about alternative management of livestock, really came together. And what we found was that the organic movement or the organic sector, not just in the UK, but throughout Europe, had no real answers to how to deal with foot and mouth disease and didn't really know very much about it. As Keith, I'm sure, will outline, there had not been any real severe outbreaks of foot and mouth in the UK since 1968, I think. There had been cases throughout the world, but nothing serious. So most farmers in the UK, this wasn't anything they'd experienced. And that was the same for academics, for researchers, and for vets. And we were at a loss, really, as to what should be the organic answer to this. Meanwhile, the government had, well, I'm jumping the gun. Maybe Keith can better explain what the policy was. But it came to a point where we, as the Organic Elm Farm Research Centre, the Organic Research Centre, decided what was being put into place as the government's response was inadequate for organic farmers. But maybe Keith can explain how that came about and how the response developed.
So yeah, I was brought up in a farming family in Somerset. It was a mixed dairy and arable farm. All my relatives were farming. And so that was a bit my background. I'm a veterinarian by background. But since the 1987, I'd been working really on international animal health issues. And then suddenly, the things that you're working on internationally suddenly were there in the UK, affecting farms similar to my own background. So that really, really was a sort of big moment for me, because from 87 through until 2001, I had really left working in mixed practice as a veterinarian in the UK, and was really dealing with the sort of international issues affecting livestock production, but also trade between countries. So in foot and mouth disease is the most explosive and infectious of the major diseases affecting ruminants, cattle, sheep and goats, but also importantly pigs. It also affects wildlife, although they're not really important in European context as a reservoir. But the UK has experience going back to the 1800s, when of course the husbandry systems were very different. And learned, in fact, in the mid-1800s, that one of the ways to get rid of major animal diseases is basically to slaughter the animals as soon as they show signs and put very strict controls on each of those farms. And by that route, which was very unpopular in the middle 1800s, they were quite successful with a range of diseases, and it became almost the way that a veterinary service would deal with exotic diseases which come into the UK. The United Kingdom, through most of the last century, had outbreaks of foot and mouth disease every year or every couple of years, quite often several outbreaks a year. But by that method of very rapid detection and response to cases, there'd often be only one or two additional cases after the first one. And that way, a robust response together with a supportive farming community, would largely nip those outbreaks in the bud. A big shock happened in the 1960s when there was an explosive outbreak that affected most of the Cheshire Plain, but also spread to other parts of the country. And then suddenly we woke up to well, there could be really explosive outbreaks. We better prepare ourselves for this. And there was a real fear that foot and mouth could get out of control with changes in the nature of farming, but also the way of introduction. So there's only one other outbreak in the 1980s was in the Isle of Wight, and that was considered to be rather significant because it was thought that it spread from infected pigs in Brittany over the channel in air, affecting a dairy farm in the Isle of Wight. So then there was a great fear that, in fact, foot and mouth could spread through the air and again could be out of control very, very easily. So that's the context to really the emergency planning, the fear that if this exotic disease came into the UK, then unless you act very, very quickly and drastically, then the spread from infected farms could easily go to the neighboring farms, could easily be spread by vehicles, by people, and be in the rest of the country. But it was assumed really that there wouldn't be any large outbreaks. They would start in the traditional way. So I think the big shock was that the system of control, the contingency plans, which had been practiced, really were for much smaller outbreaks. And then suddenly you were faced with this situation in which within the first week you realized that infection was really widespread across the UK. And that was something that was an almost impossible situation for them to apply the usual control measures, because those usual control measures involve a large number of personnel being available to check out all the farms connected to suspicions or proven infections. And that requires a lot of trained individuals ready to go, available, knowing what to deal with, and knowing just how infectious this disease is when they don't have daily experience as farm animal vets of dealing with anything like foot and mouth disease, because the usual diseases in the UK are not infectious in the same way. So suddenly all these things had to be mobilized very, very quickly. There was a fear it was out of control, that there were sources of infection that would be popping up because they were appearing almost without a clear pattern to start with. And that was something really unprecedented in the history. So just to say the way it appeared, first of all, in an abattoir in Essex, was traced back to pigs which had come from the north of England. While they were doing the tracing, additional cases popped up, and tracing them back, they appeared to be linked to major livestock markets, some of the most busy in Europe. And soon it was apparent that if there was one source, there was also there were many movements which had happened that had seeded this infection to, you know, at least 50 different centres across the UK, from which it was spreading to farms in the vicinity. And that is that's a huge challenge for any administration to deal with. And really that sort of exercised a great deal of concern about could the people available be sufficient to use the traditional agenda of simply slaughtering the farms that showed the first signs of disease and those that were immediately in contact. That was considered a traditional veterinary approach that might not be appropriate given the panic, given the scale of concern, given the apparent out of control nature that newspapers and the assessments from a distance suggest was the case, you know, within the first couple of weeks of the outbreak.
Thanks, Keith. And then maybe for those that don't know, you could give an overview of how foot and mouth disease spreads.
Yes, well, there's the, we have to remember that it's an incredibly infectious agent, and what it causes are blisters on the tongue and on the hooves. That's why it's called foot and mouth disease. And those blisters have extraordinary levels of infection in them, sufficient to potentially infect, you know, hundreds of thousands of animals if they are on the right form of contamination. So the usual form of spread is really that animals breathe out quite large concentrations of virus. But because they drool and because their hooves are seeping infected virus into the ground, then there's lots of other points of contamination that could be carried by vehicles off farm. So the usual way of thinking about it is to say, let's stop everything moving off the farm, animals, people, feed trucks, milk. And that way, you know, infection should not spread, except it might spread over the fence because those animals might be infected. And you know, that might go to the neighboring farm, which has sharing, you know, within 100 meters or within a close distance. The fear is that so many movements were happening on and off farm that the old idea that you could keep farms rigidly isolated was next to impossible, particularly in sort of wet, cold British spring weather conditions.
It's very hard to get across to people who weren't around, probably not even born at that time, just the sense of panic and being out of control. The contentious issues that emerged is to how and why the tried and tested method of rapidly stopping all movements didn't happen. What was the reason for the delays? The discovery of the outbreak in the abattoir in Essex, and then the being traced back to this farm in Northumberland, did seem to take time. But there was then a question, and as we say, becomes controversial. Lots of some investigative journalists got involved with this, did regular updates. The whole aspects right across the board, but also what really was happening. So there was a number of theories. The big question was, why was it not possible to close down the markets as quickly as traditionally would have happened? What was different in 2001 was the development of livestock movements by lorry from markets to markets. And one or two traders were identified as prime movers from the early stages. So people who would basically buy animals in one market and move them to the next market, move them back to their holding farms, and then move them out again until they were sold. And those movements were able to shift animals from the northeast of England right to the southwest and so on, and then move them around. So that complete change in how markets functioned, big markets functioned, and this movement of animals was a major change from anything we'd known before. So it was probably almost impossible for the traditional methods to deal with. So that, I think that's pretty uncontroversial, but at the time that was a big issue. And then underlying this was the other question of trade and the need and policy being driven by the need to maintain the UK's foot and mouth disease free status. There had been smaller outbreaks in other parts of the world, which had been treated by vaccination. Vaccination at that time would have, unless the animals were vaccinated to slaughter, would have contravened or called into question the UK's foot and mouth disease free status. So we weren't facing simply with dealing with the disease. It had to be dealt with in some way that would maintain the disease, the trade status as a disease-free nation. So the options became rather limited. I think that, have I got that right, Keith? Is that's a kind of policy background to this?
Yes, I mean, maybe just to add a bit to that. I mean, really, in the first part of the last century, the first, I would say, really up until about 1970, then foot and mouth was a major epidemic on a every year or every couple of years in Europe. Sweeping epidemics would spread across Europe. Now, Europe in the 60s really ramped up vaccination. You know, in the way that we're seeing now with this discussion about COVID, every country trying to reach, pretty much all of them wanted to use vaccination rather than having slaughter, and adopted almost all of them, with the exception of the UK and Ireland, adopted vaccination as the routine. And this continued successfully, and with the result that foot and mouth, with other controls, essentially disappeared in the early 1980s from Europe. So a bit like COVID, the idea that if we get enough vaccination into the population, then with some more limited controls, we can kind of stop epidemics, because most of the population of cattle, at least, would be vaccinated. UK and Ireland, you know, after the process of joining the EU, the question came up, can we drop vaccination because we've been successful in Europe? And it was decided very quickly to stop vaccinating in 1990 and become free as a group of EU countries, so that the UK, Ireland would have the same status with other countries, enabling livestock movements very much broadly across the EU, and a preferential trade status because they would be free of foot and mouth, enabling those animals from the UK and Europe potentially to be traded anywhere in the world with this sort of super gold standard of freedom from foot and mouth disease. So into that context, then international rules were brought that actually made the status of free countries like the UK to be this sort of very elevated position. And those that used vaccination had to really prove themselves not to be hiding disease. And because it was considered, if you've vaccinated, you may be difficult to tell if there is still infection in that population. So that created two sets of countries free of disease or using vaccine, which were little better to some extent than countries that were infected. So we were in that situation in 2001 in which the international rules, if you used vaccination, was that it would need much longer to be able to, very, very much longer, to be able to prove eventually that you were free of disease. And it might, in fact, in trade negotiations, take a couple of years to convince your major trade partners that if you'd use vaccine, that that you didn't have residual infection. So faced with that, the sort of certainty was, well, if you slaughter everything, even if it is if slaughtering a significant population of your national herd, you might in the end gain your trade status far quicker, a matter of 3 months, rather than possibly 12 or even longer, according to your, you know, negotiations with international trade partners. So there was some certainty about what happens if you don't vaccinate, that it would be potentially awful in terms of the amount that you'd need to slaughter. And there was much more concern about how you maintain business if you start using vaccine. But Europe had been using vaccine for successfully, in the case of the Netherlands, for at least 40 years, and had learned, you know, you can eat vaccinated products, you can eat, you can drink the milk. There's no health risk associated with vaccine. So the public were very, very confused with this situation in which apparently the vaccines were safe, the products were safe, that you could vaccinate. There was existing vaccines. Europe and UK had access to International Bank, the EU Bank of Vaccines. So the question was in people's mind, you know, what is the real reason for not using vaccines? So that was quite a debate. Some people would say, well, at the time, were saying, well, that probably they don't work. If they're not being used, it must be because they don't work. And others were recognizing that the heart of it was really this economic argument about the trade status of individual farms, regions using vaccines, and then whole parts of the UK.
So the debate within the farming community was very, very polarized, very sharp, very difficult. And within the organic sector, things were also difficult because faced only with a slaughter policy, and all the organic movement had to offer was some vague ideas as to what Albert Howard might have done, Albert Howard in India decades ago had allowed foot and mouth to in cattle to continue and had just dealt with it by feeding organic feed. That was offered as a kind of way forward. Didn't sound very convincing, but that was offered as a way forward. Some people, and initially we were also arguing that depending on the type of foot and mouth, in some cases, the foot and mouth, an animal can be exposed to it without having serious illness, serious animal welfare issues, and can recover. So people within the organic sector were also arguing that. And it turns out that actually, probably in this case, that may well have been the situation with sheep as opposed to cattle, because it affects animals in different ways. So the organic sector was overall wanting to follow the government line, which was containment through slaughter and trying to contain it. Elm Farm Research Centre, Organic Research Centre, had a number of farmer clients, and we said, actually, this really is not good enough. This is not a response. And particularly as the slaughter gathered momentum and you started to have bonfires of animals throughout the country, people became very, very unhappy about this. And a number of our farmers came to us and said, can you do anything? We can't just sit back and let this happen. And at this point, we took the view that we had to examine the government's policy and to seek a judicial review, because we did not think that this policy was adequate and had taken all factors into account, notably the use of vaccination. The development of the so-called contiguous cull, which moved the policy of culling animals, supercharged it into a whole different ballgame. And again, this was at the time very controversial, very contested. And I think maybe Keith, who was really right in the middle of this, is probably best to explain how contiguous cull came about and what the drivers were for it.
Yes. So how did I get in to meet Lawrence? How did that happen? Well, I was, as I said at the time, I was at the Centre for Tropical Veterinary Medicine, and I was actually in Kenya seeing animals as part of the research projects that I had at the time when the outbreak broke out. And you know, having discussions with people in Kenya about the nature of foot and mouth disease control and the use of vaccines, that's just been part of the work that I've done. So to come back to the UK and to find that quite a lot of colleagues were volunteering, joining Ministry of Agriculture, going off to become the farm vets, chasing around after cases of foot and mouth disease. You know, I really sort of scratched my head when I looked at the scale of what was happening, and trying to understand what could I contribute in this situation. And at the time, seeing almost no discussion taking place about the alternatives to whether there really was anything else that could be done. And I think what particularly affected me was the arguments that appeared that said, well, vaccines don't work. There are plenty of histories of cases in the literature where where foot and mouth occurs in vaccinated animals. And I thought, yes, it's just like our experience with cars. You know, we didn't stop driving cars when we found that they broke down. You know, we understood each of those what was wrong and set about trying to find a way to use vaccines in an effective way, conscious of what they give, what they can do, and their limitations. And there's been such a volume of European literature, South American literature on the use of vaccines, because it was very much part of the way that Europe eradicated the disease. So suddenly we had this sort of situation. I had master's students who were asking as well to understand this situation, and observing almost every day the disease control changing and becoming in many ways more drastic and with less clarity about the rationale for it. And I think when it got to the point of saying that sheep within 3 kilometers of an infected farm would all have to be slaughtered, whether they showed any signs of, or not, that I think, you know, a lot of us as veterinarians, especially if you have any experience of this infection, would say, you know, it's very hard to conclude that that is the only way of dealing with it. Plus, we're dealing with special breeds as well, in many cases in the Lake District, that are really adapted to their hill conditions, have been there for, bred for generations, and we're going to lose those in this setting. So that sort of led me really to say, well, you know, there are issues with vaccination, particularly the economic ones we talked about, but there's also a lot of science that says we know how to use them. We know their limitations. We know how to test animals after vaccination, not perfectly, but we can detect the difference between an infected animal and a vaccinated animal. This needs to just be said somewhere that an economic case might be the right one to justify the, but it's not the case that vaccines themselves do not work. And I was in the situation where really no academic was at that stage willing to sort of go public, and there were some instructions that this is so sensitive, so political, that really to keep out of this. And for that reason, I decided in the end to write a letter to the Daily Telegraph under a pseudonym, just setting out some of the key facts that would mean that vaccines should not be ignored completely in the discussion of disease control.
So that brings us to the end of part one of this podcast. Keep your eyes peeled for part two on the website. If you would like to find out more about the ORC, whether that be our research, knowledge exchange or policy activity, please visit our website. I have included a link in the podcast introductory information to our homepage. You can also follow us on social media, Twitter, Facebook or LinkedIn, as well as signing up to our bulletin or e-bulletin via the contact part of our website. Please also keep checking our 40th anniversary webpage for latest celebratory content, including podcasts, webinars and research fact sheets, which will look back on some of our most pioneering research over the last 40 years.